You're listening to Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock.
Big John McCarthy has witnessed the best that the UFC had to offer.
That is it! Game, set, match! We have a new champion!
Your backstage pass to the world of mixed martial arts and combat sports on the Lineup Media Group Podcast Network.
Let's get it on!
Hey everyone, welcome to Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and me, Sean Wheelock. Every week on this podcast, John and I give you an inside look at MMA and combat sports, always separating fact from fiction. On this week's program, we'll examine the eight-man lightweight tournament held by World Series of Fighting at their event last Friday in Phoenix, Arizona, which was won by Brian Foster, even though he lost in the quarterfinals. Big John and I will also discuss the still ongoing search by Ryzen FF to find an opponent for Fedor Emelianenko when he makes his return to MMA on December 31st. Plus, we'll look at the surprising number of split decisions, four in all, including the main event that occurred at last Saturday's UFC Fight Night in Monterrey, Mexico. And as we do on every episode of Let's Get It On, John will answer your questions. Submit them via email, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com, and on Twitter by using the hashtag AskBJM. Remember that you can download and subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes Store. For Android, download the Stitcher app and subscribe. And you can go straight to our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. Let's Get It On is brought to you by audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/letsgetiton. There are over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, and MP3 player. Well, this past Friday, World Series of Fighting 25 took place in Phoenix, Arizona, and featured a one-night eight-man lightweight tournament. In an odd turn of events, Brian Foster emerged victorious despite having been defeated in the quarterfinal round. So, John, two of the winning quarterfinalists were unable to continue due to injury. Two losing quarterfinalists were able to advance to the semifinal round, and the entire event gave a very clear illustration of why one-night eight-fighter tournaments, to me, are pretty much largely a relic of MMA's past.
You see, this is what's wrong with goddamn tournaments anymore. Everyone keeps on there, it's gonna be great, it's the best, we're gonna have a tournament, we're gonna do this. You just had a tournament and it falls apart on you, just like they're all gonna fall apart on you. You're asking too much of the fighters. You're asking guys to go in, fight a fight, and come back in an era where it's not the same as it was in the past. In the past, we had guys that truly didn't understand how to fight, you know, the way they do now. And what's happening now is you're having to go through someone and your body is getting beat down. It's getting damaged in that fight and you can't continue on. And it's ridiculous that we keep on having tournaments. They are antiquated. I'm not saying that, you know what, well, we shouldn't have them anymore. You know, there could be something where someone comes up with something and say, yeah, that makes sense. But right now, especially when you're going to say we're going to do an eight-man tournament, it's freaking ridiculous. It's stupid. They should stop it.
I understand what World Series of Fighting is trying to do. They're trying to establish their identity. They're not just behind the UFC. They're behind Bellator, and television ratings in the U.S. and Canada spell this out very clearly. But trying to revive this concept that you were a part of in the mid-1990s, the Art Davey era UFC, there was a reason why Art Davey moved off of this and the reason why tournament formats went away, because predictably they do fall apart. Look no further, MMA historians, than back to the name of Steve Jenham.
Okay, yeah. You know, and everyone looks at that at the time. It's like, you know, oh, that's not fair. There's never going to be total fair. And when you start looking at the way things were then and then trying to bring those into today's element of fighters and the way people are fighting and what's going on, it doesn't freaking match up. It's like trying to put a freaking square peg in a round hole. You're making a mistake. I understand the World Series of Fighting is trying to get people to, you know, watch them. They're trying to come up with concepts that are new and interesting. Totally understand it. But you know what? The tournament concept in the form of doing it all in one night is always going to backfire on you. It's going to end up having fighters that are pulled out or cannot continue on based upon injuries that are occurring in the fight that they just had. And so now we're going to say, okay, we're going to have a
you know, if the winning fighter can't go on, then we'll go to the losing fighter and see if the losing fighter wants to go on. And so now we bring a losing fighter back into the tournament. So what are you saying about your tournament? You just made it look bad by bringing the losing fighter back in. You just can't do it. It doesn't work out for you. So then you're going to say, well, we've got alternate. So we'll bring the alternate. But then most people are not watching that on TV. And so they lose the concept of the tournament. The tournament just doesn't work anymore.
In this tournament, they did have an alternate bout. It was the first fight of the night. It wasn't part of the NBCSN broadcast. And actually, the entire quarterfinal round wasn't on the main television broadcast. But Ramil Mustapayev wins the alternate bout. If I'm his manager, I'm not really thrilled with World Series of Fighting, because then he is bypassed by Brian Foster and George Pitino, who both lose in the quarterfinals.
Yeah,
so
but
why
they knew
even
that.
Then have an alternate
they knew that
bout?
Going in there. Look, you can't sit there and say that he's going to complain, because they knew the structure. They were told the structure. You're an alternate. If one of the winners cannot move forward, we will first go to the losing fighters. And if the losing fighter doesn't want to go forward, then we will go to the alternate. That's the way they're all doing it right now. So that's in, you know, that's in the paperwork. They know exactly when they're going to be looked at to be brought into it. So there's no complaint there.
So what I wonder, though, John, is so you have the two losers going through, and Foster loses by heel hook, and Pitino loses by two-round decision. The opening round, the quarterfinals, were two-round fights. What if they were both knocked out or TKO'd? So now you only have one alternate, which means you only have three semifinalists. Or does the state of Arizona decide, well, we're going to waive that medical suspension even though you got TKO'd and let you fight 40 minutes later?
I would think that the state of Arizona and their athletic commission and Matt Valenzuela, who's there, would say no. You know, he can't go on. And if you you can figure out which two you want to fight for your finals, but we're not going to allow someone that got knocked out or stopped due to head trauma come back and fight again. That's not going to happen. So, you know, that same thing happened with Bellator when I talk about, you know, Mo Law fought Linton Vassell, and Mo Law won the fight, then said he couldn't continue on in the tournament, and they wanted to go to Linton Vassell, and the doctor said, nope, he's medically suspended. He cannot fight. I will not allow him to fight. So they went to, you know,
Francis Carmo,
who was their alternate. So, you know, that's part of, you know, the regulatory body's job to protect fighters. And, you know, sometimes they got to protect them from themselves. Sometimes they got to protect them from a promoter that wants them to come out and do something so their show works. You can't have it. If the guy has been injured in a way, especially when it comes to any type of concussion or sustained head trauma, that person cannot continue fighting.
Let's talk about the state of Arizona in a moment and allowing this tournament, which goes against the unified rules. But just a point on the finishing of this tournament. So it was a fun fight, Brian Foster versus Zhao Jeffarino. But again, this is a rematch of something
they did
happened
twice
earlier in the night. It reminded me of like that 1950s pro wrestling where it's best two out of three falls. Like they're going to fight an hour later then.
Well, you know, the best part about it, I look at it, at least it proves to people, look it. Just because someone beats someone on a given day or a given night doesn't mean that they can beat them the second time. And this is true. And that's part of MMA. And that's why, you know, when people start getting into this, oh, he beat him. So it may, look it. Anything can happen in a fight. I say it all the time. Anybody can win. You know, you make a mistake, you can lose the fight. Brian went in there, he made a mistake in the first one, and he didn't make the same mistake in the second one, and he ended up coming out with a win in that one. But, you know, this is part of tournaments where all these things that are occurring, you know, are all problems for the promoter, they're problems for the fighters, they're problems for the officials. And at this point, I think, you know, we need to get smart enough to say, all right, it's time to get rid of the tournament formats. We're done with it. Yes, there's promoters going to want to do it, and no, we're not going to allow it. It's just not part of the sport of 2015, 2016.
So World Series of Fighting really had to search to find a home for this tournament. I have a lot of respect for the Arizona Commission. I think they're very solid. Matthew Valenzuela, who runs the commission, I think is outstanding. But still, there was some heat coming Arizona's way because, again, in the unified rules, you can fight a maximum of 25 minutes of MMA. The way this was structured, so in the quarterfinals, the opening round, it's 2 5-minute rounds. Then threes in the semifinals, 3 fives, and 3 fives to the finals. So potentially you could fight 40 minutes, 15 more than the unified rules allows. And even if you look in boxing, the maximum you can go is 12 3-minute rounds, 36 minutes. Again, yeah. There was the potential. No one reached it, but there was the potential you could go 40 minutes, John.
Yeah, well, and the potential of you dying out as far as no energy and not being able to compete at a high level is definitely there. But, you know, it didn't get to that. But, you know, the whole point is, why are we subjecting fighters to things and pushing the envelope on their capabilities of performing at a high level and performing in a way that is, you know, entertaining for the audience and then also healthy for them and healthy as far as their safety? Why are we pushing the envelope on this? Why are we doing this to people? You know, fighters, you know, when a promoter comes up to them and says, hey, you know, I've got this tournament, you want to do it? A fighter is always going to say, yeah, I want to do it. Okay, yeah, I'll do it. They're going to do anything when there's a payday associated to it. And that's the way they look at it. And I don't blame them. But that's what regulatory bodies are for, is to say, yeah, you know what? We're not going to quite let it go this way. And, you know, if you're going to sit there and say, I want a tournament, I'm okay with doing the tournaments where you break it down into a four-man tournament, four-woman tournament, depending upon whatever you have, and you give them a two-round first fight, you give them a three-round. It's the same as, you know, fighting a main event in the UFC or a championship fight in UFC, Bellator, or World Series of Fighting. Okay, you know, that's fine. You want to do that? I'll say it's all right. But when you start getting past it, you're getting past the point of being smart as far as fighter safety. And that's anytime that you're starting to tinker with fighter safety, you're probably making a mistake.
Every week here on Let's Get It On, we bring you our poll question. You can cast your vote on our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. Last week we asked, do you feel that Holly Holm's victory against Ronda Rousey ranks as the biggest upset in MMA history? 63% of you voted yes. This week's poll question, are you in favor of one-night, eight-fighter MMA tournaments? Vote yes or no on our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. John, I know what your vote is. To me, it's fighter safety, but then they just structurally fall apart time and time again. Again, you referenced Bellator in September in San Jose. It's a four-man light heavyweight tournament. It falls apart. It's just a different sport than it was in 1996, and you can't try to force things that worked 19, 20, 21 years ago now into our modern fighting era.
No, it's, you know, again, it's trying to fit that freaking round peg in the square hole. It's just stupid. It gets to a point, when are promoters going to figure it out? You know what? The thing that I can do is put eyes on my product by putting the best product forward as possible, and that's not always by putting more fights on or by putting tournament type fights on to try to draw interest. You just got to start, you know, doing some marketing behind your fighters. And when you get, you know, certain people in there, and World Series of Fighting has some great fighters, you know, Justin Gaethje, that dude can fight, man. And, you know, they're trying this lightweight tournament is to bring someone that's going to fight him now. And Brian Foster has already fought him before. You know, it's as a, you know, when you've got a guy that stands out like he does in their promotion, it's tough for you to be able to do things as far as, you know, getting people to put eyes on you and be excited about your promotion. But it's a tough situation.
John, final point on this. Last year we saw Battlegrounds MMA. They did a one-night, eight-fighter tournament in Oklahoma. They haven't been heard from since. World Series of Fighting clearly is not going away, but do you think these eight-man tournaments with World Series of Fighting are going away? Do you think they've learned their lesson now?
I hope they've learned their lesson. I hope they understand that, you know what, this is it didn't work for us. And since it didn't work for us, well, let's move on from it. But you know what? You never know until give them the second chance and we'll see what happens. But I would hope they'd be smart enough to say, all right, this is not what we thought was going to occur. And so we got to move on.
You know, I can give them Art Davies' cell phone number. He can very articulately explain why he moved away from one-night eight-fighter tournaments in the mid-1990s with the UFC. Every week on this podcast, John and I answer your questions. Ask away via email, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com, on Twitter by using the hashtag AskBJM, and now by using SpeakPipe on our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. And of course, please, please, please include a pronunciation guide for your name. First up from Twitter, @WooWell7, no pronunciation guide needed for WooWell7. He asked, John, do you let some fighters take more of a beating who you know can handle it, such as Frankie Edgar and Nick Diaz, before you step in?
No. That's the most ridiculous thing I hear all the time. Oh, if you know a guy can take a beating, do you let him take more of a beating? You don't judge it based upon, oh, that guy can take more, so I'm just going to let him take more abuse. You judge it on, are they actively a participant in the competition? Are they still fighting? Their ability to take punishment allows them to stay an active competitor at that point in the fight. And so, yes, you're going to let things go on, because if they're actively being competitive in it, but they've taken abuse, but they can do it and continue to be competitive, you're going to let the fight go on. But when it comes to the point, no matter who the person is, I don't care what kind of chin you say they have or how much damage they can take. Everyone at a certain point can become overwhelmed to the point where they are no longer an active competitor in the fight. They are now more of a victim than they are a competitor. And our job is to take care of the fighter when they cannot take care of themselves. It doesn't matter what their last name is.
Next up, Tommy Toehold, who has a great MMA program, the Tommy Toehold Show. Honored that he asked the question to you, John. Very nicely done, Tommy Toehold. So, John, can a corner throw in the towel in the UFC?
Yes. You know, this is so misplaced in what people say and think.
It really is, isn't it?
It's ridiculous. All right, I'm going to break it down from the very beginning, okay? Little history lesson for everyone here. Back when we did the unified rules in April of 2001, okay, there were certain people there. Mark Ratner was not there, but he was on a teleconference listening to the entire procedure go down. And at a certain point near the end, Mark voiced up and said that in the state of Nevada, they did not like the throwing of the towel. They didn't want to have it because in MMA, that had been a big part of, you know, what we allowed. In the state of Nevada, they didn't like having a corner throw in the towel. They liked if the corner wanted the fight stopped, they liked to have the corner tell the inspector that was part of their team, tell that person, we want the fight stopped. The inspector would get up and inform the referee to stop the fight. Now, it's a more convoluted, you know, way of doing it, but that's the way that allowed. So it was put into the unified rules. It was rule number 31. All right. In 2010, the rules committee for the ABC came up with a change in the rules. Their big changes were they took and put spitting and biting together. So instead of 31, we went to 30. And then they actually took away the throwing of the towel as a foul. And so we went to 29 fouls. And the throwing of the towel was not something under the unified rules that was a foul. So you as a trainer, if you wanted the fight stopped, being that you were, you know, working in a state that went by the unified rules, you were able to throw the towel, unless that state was really Nevada, because Nevada in their regulations says, no, you may not throw the towel. So if you're working in the state of Nevada, you may not throw the towel to stop the fight. You must tell the inspector. The inspector will get up onto the cage and inform the referee to stop the fight. Other than that, yes, you can frickin' throw the towel to stop the fight.
In my home state of Kansas, John, we still have the rule on the books. If it's any combative sport that we regulate, so boxing, MMA, kickboxing, if the towel is thrown in, it's an automatic disqualification to that corner's fighter.
And what's wrong with
still
that?
You know, the
that's all, the whole purpose of it is you want the fight stopped. The reason Nevada doesn't like it is they were always afraid that some fool would end up throwing a towel in and that there would be a stopping of the fight and that there would be confusion along with it, because they've had incidents occur that, you know, have had major confusion. You know, they've had fan man. Christ, they had a guy try to fly into a ring with a parachute and a motor.
Holyfield Bow.
Exactly. So they, you know, they're looking at it saying, look, we want this to be as, you know, well controlled as possible. So if a towel comes into the ring in Nevada, the referee is going to ignore it. He's going to just keep the fight going and he'll, you know, move the towel out and there's no stopping of the action. And that's fine. When I work in Nevada, I know exactly what the rule is. But in any other situation, if I'm working in California, we'll say, and the towel comes in, I'm going to call a stop. I'm going to see which corner threw in the towel and I'm going to stop the fight. And if it becomes where we have, you know, states that have it on legislation, the throwing of the towel will be a disqualification. Well, if you want the fight stopped, it's a great way to get the disqualification. Fine, boom, do it. It, you know, it's really not a hard situation. But what we have is we have trainers that use it as an excuse of, well, I was told I couldn't do it. That's bullshit. If you as a trainer have a question, there's this thing called a referee that walks in the back for every frickin' fight. And he ends up, if he's at least an intelligent referee, he takes the fighter and his chief second and brings him over and starts talking to him and ask him in the end, do you have any questions? Is there anything I can answer for you? No. Guess what? Then you're saying you know the rules. If you don't know if you can throw the towel, then ask.
John, you remember the case of the boxing referee, Arthur McCanty Jr., not senior, but Arthur McCanty Jr. You know what I'm going to talk about.
Oh, I don't
referee
want to, I don't want to talk
Foreman
about this
in New York. I don't want to talk
about
it.
I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about this. Bad.
No, but it's really and it hurt his career because he kicked the towel out and he took a lot of heat. It was a fight at Yankee Stadium on HBO.
Well, you know, let's be honest. There was a lot more that went
there was with that
besides he threw the towel out. He was talking to Yuri Foreman saying, you don't want to end it like this, champ, right, champ? You know, you don't do that. The inspector did come up onto the apron and told him the corner wanted the fight stopped, and he said no. You don't do the things that were done in that fight. Your job as a referee is not to basically take a side. You know, if you end up taking a side and trying to help a fighter, you're making a huge mistake in what you're doing as far as your abilities, your powers. And that whole situation was not good. Arthur McCanty Jr. is a fine boxing official. He made a mistake mentally in that fight, and he should have stopped the fight when, you know, he was told to. He didn't do that, and he paid the price for it, and now he's back and he's working well. So God bless him.
This question from Kieran Boswell, coming from my wife's home country of England. John, how do you feel about stomping opponents' feet? And Kieran continues, it just seems dirty to me. Not a submission skill, just breaking feet.
Well, I want to know how many feet has she seen broken with a heel stomp on the foot. I love how people come up with this. Oh, they're breaking feet. You know what? How many fights have you seen stopped because of a stomp? None. Now, I'm telling you personally, I don't like it either. You know, I think, you know, it's ugly, you know, and I don't want to see someone, you know, taken out of a fight possibly with a foot injury based upon a stomp. But it's part of the sport. And, you know, I don't sit there and because I don't personally like it, I don't sit there and say, well, it shouldn't be done. It's been part of the sport for a long time. It's an effective technique in getting someone to move if you're trying for takedowns, if you're trying to get them to move off of the fence or have to, you know, balance themselves in a different fashion so you can get the takedown. And when you sit there and say it's dirty, it's not dirty. Why is it dirty to stomp on someone's foot? But it's absolutely just incredibly clean to elbow them to the face or punch them to the face or kick them to the face. We have no problem with someone getting hit to the face. That is an okay thing throughout the world. But God knows we don't want them to kick at a knee or stomp on a foot. My God, that's just – it's horrible. It's so unsportsmanlike.
To me, it's like you talk about getting them to move. It's like sometimes you'll see fighters kind of palm strike or slap the ears. Yep. They're not inflicting damage. They're just trying to get the fighter to move position.
Yep. You know, it's just – that's called smart fighting, you know. And it's – there's certain things, you know, no one is going to like everything associated with the sport as far as what they can or cannot do. There's people that think that we should, you know, allow knees to the head of a grounded fighter, and there's people that don't. There's people that think that, you know what, smothering is a horrible thing, and there's people that think, no, it's a great thing because it makes the guy do this. You know, you're never going to have everybody liking every rule or non-rule that we have. It's, you know, just accept it. It is what it is. The fighters deal with it. They understand it. And as long as they understand it and step in there understanding what the rules are and stuff, you should be good with it too.
Remember, email us your questions, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com, and submit them on Twitter by using the hashtag AskBJM. Still to come on this week's episode of Let's Get It On, John and I will discuss the ongoing search, which quite frankly has turned into a saga, to find an opponent for Fedor Emelianenko when he makes his return to MMA at Ryzen FF on New Year's Eve in Japan, and we'll examine the unusually high number of split decisions from last Saturday's UFC Fight Night in Mexico, which included the Neil Magny versus Kevin Gastelum main event. With Big John McCarthy, I'm Sean Wheelock, and you are listening to Let's Get It On.
Hey guys, if you're a fan of Let's Get It On and want to show us some love and support our podcast, before your next Amazon purchase, go to our website at letsgetitonpodcast.com and click the Amazon banner on the right-hand side of the page. It doesn't cost you anything, and there are no extra steps to go through. But doing this supports the podcast and allows us to continue to bring you great content every week. Remember, before you shop on Amazon, go to our website at letsgetitonpodcast.com and click the Amazon banner on the right side of the page. Thanks a lot.
Let's Get It On is presented by Audible.com. Audible is now offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. To download your free audiobook today, go online to audibletrial.com/letsgetiton. Again, that is audibletrial.com/letsgetiton for your free audiobook.
When looking for new and exciting clothing concepts, look no further than Lambs to Lions. Lambs to Lions has great designs that incorporates the past from boxing with the new and exciting evolution of MMA. We all start out as lambs, but with time, training, and hard work, we can all become lions. Be part of the Lambs to Lions movement and check out all of their great designs. You can get your Lambs to Lions gear at the Las Vegas Fight Shop or go to lambstolionsbrand.com.
Now, back to Let's Get It On with your hosts, Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock.
Two weeks ago here on this program, John and I talked about the announcement that Tsuyoshi Kosaka, the 45-year-old former Japanese MMA fighter, would come out of retirement to face Fedor Emelianenko, the 39-year-old MMA fighter from Russia, who's also set to come out of retirement. Now comes word from the promotion Ryzen FF directly that Kosaka will still fight on the card New Year's Eve in Japan, but his opponent will be the Englishman James Thompson. And John, it looks as though Ryzen is still looking for an opponent for Fedor Emelianenko. I don't want to say this is getting embarrassing, but it's not looking great for this startup promotion.
No, it's not good at all. You know, to sit there and you have one side of your, main event being Fedor, and everyone knows it. But it's been now how long since they announced it? You know, let's be honest. It was back in September, I think, that they announced it, and it's now middle of November, and they still don't have somebody that is the opponent for Fedor. This is not looking good. It's not a good position for them. They're obviously struggling with finding someone that is going to be acceptable, and this is part of the problem with that new promotion.
Well, first they talked about Jadeep Singh, who's now 2-0 in MMA, but he made his name in kickboxing. He was 1-0 at the time. There was almost universal disapproval, saying, what a joke opponent for the former best fighter on the planet, at least in a lot of people's opinion, including my own. So he's out, so then Kosaka comes in. Of course, we talked about it 2 weeks ago. Kosaka on that controversial elbow gave Fedor Emelianenko his first defeat. Emelianenko avenged that defeat in pride. But the reality is Kosaka, as great as he was, is 45 and hasn't fought since 2006. So he didn't really look like that good of an opponent. But at the same time, Fedor Emelianenko, John, coming back, he's been retired since 2012. He's 39 years old. Truthfully, that Ryzen, Sakakibara, who's heading Ryzen, they don't want to see Fedor Emelianenko lose. So when you talk about, well, who's out there? Maybe from Bellator, maybe Bobby Lashley. That's not a great matchup for Fedor Emelianenko.
No, I don't think you're going to see Bobby Lashley flying to Japan to take on Fedor. You know, it's maybe Bobby Lashley 4 or 5 years ago when he first started. Maybe, you know,
right.
that might have been a good fight. Not now. Bobby is absolutely improved who he is as a fighter. And he's someone who is he's formidable. And I'm not saying that Fedor couldn't beat him, but I'm not saying that he couldn't beat Fedor. And that's exactly what you're talking about, is Ryzen cannot afford to have that. If Fedor is going to be the guy that they're riding the coattails of, then they need to find someone that they say, oh, he can beat this guy, and I really don't have to worry too much about it. And that's part of the problem with promoting when you're going with one person as your star, and this is the person you have to have win. Well, then you got to try to set things up in a fashion where you are fairly confident that your guy is going to come out on top. And that's not always going to happen, and sometimes it doesn't lead towards the best fights either.
But you hit on the dilemma, because Ryzen clearly, and I'm not saying it's a work, absolutely not am I saying this is a work, but promotionally, Ryzen clearly wants Fedor Emelianenko to win, but at the same time, they really got the jeers on Jadeep Singh, they got the jeers on Tsuyoshi Kosaka, so they have to find an opponent that at least seems relevant, like maybe they could possibly win this fight, but not someone who probably can win this fight.
Yeah, you know, they're not gonna be able to appease, you know, everybody. That's just not gonna happen. And especially when you're looking at North America compared to, you know, Japan, and there's gonna be a huge difference in what the Japanese people will accept and what, you know, North Americans are gonna accept as a viable opponent. And I just don't see that you're gonna be able to get somebody that's gonna be a viable opponent in the eyes of people from North America against Fedor, unless you put somebody that is somewhere in the top 10, and they're not going to do that.
When we first started talking about Fedor Emelianenko's return to MMA and going into Ryzen, we were talking about on this program before Ryzen FF was even officially given its name, but Nobuyuki Sakakibara, the former boss of Pride, who's launching this, we knew that he wanted Fedor Emelianenko as the centerpiece. At the time, we were speculating, well, who could even fight that's not under contract? But Ryzen has come out and said, we'll be working with Bellator and KSW in Poland and Jungle Fight in Brazil. So there are available heavyweights. It's not as though they can't find anybody and they do have to get a retired fighter like Kosaka. But again, it's that dilemma. Do they want to see Fedor Emelianenko win? Do they want to see him win in squashes, win competitively? Do they want to see him win by a narrow margin where people think maybe he needs to go back into retirement? Again, you just hit on it. When you're really banking the startup of your promotion on one fighter, it's a really slippery slope.
Very slippery. In fact, it's icy. You know, and it's funny because you get people that, you know, they're sitting there, you know, they'll talk about like Ronda Rousey and Holly Holm, the UFC, and they're saying, you know, oh, that kills the UFC that Rousey lost. No, it doesn't. This is the part of being a promoter that you need to understand. If a promoter is sitting there banking on one person winning, they're not being smart as a promoter. A promoter puts the fight together because they think it's going to be a fight that they can sell, that they're going to make money on, and whoever wins is going to be good for them. You know, Jose Aldo is going to fight, you know, Conor McGregor. You know what? Either guy, if Conor wins, it's great for the UFC. If Aldo wins, it's great for the UFC, because either way, it's going to work for them. That's what you as a promoter need. If you go into that fight needing one guy to beat the other, now you're starting to walk on that little tightrope, and that tightrope can be very small at times, and you can fall off the side of it real easy.
Well, Pro Elite, Elite XC, they went out of business when Seth Petruzzelli was named as the replacement for Ken Shamrock, and he finished very quickly Kimbo Slice. That was the death of their promotion. They were never back again. And I know early on in Bellator, there were fighters who the promotion very much wanted to win. Again, I'm not alleging works, absolutely not, but just promotionally, they wanted fighters to win. It's funny how history worked out, because Pat Curran has emerged as an absolutely phenomenal 145-pound fighter, but back in the spring of 2010, Roger Huerta was the big money signing for Bellator. Bellator really wanted Roger Huerta to win that tournament and then defeat Eddie Alvarez for the title.
Let's
history
say Bjorn
kind of took some turns and it worked out well, but at the time it was kind of ruinous for the company.
Let's say Bjorn Rebney really wanted Roger Huerta to win. Bjorn Rebney had a hard on for Roger Huerta, man. He wanted him from the very beginning. That was his star child. And you know, look at, you know, this is where you know, opinions. You know, people think they know fighting, and you know, Bjorn Rebney, no disrespect to him at all, but he thought he really knew fighting, and he didn't know dick. He had an idea that certain people were way better than what they really were. He was told about certain people. He was told about, you know, what could happen. And he was smarter than everyone and knew that, no, this was the guy. And then it was proved to him by certain fighters, no, it's not. And that's just, that's part of being a promoter. Again, you don't put yourself in a position where you need to have a specific person win a fight. You do that, you're probably making mistakes.
And it's probably not going to turn out. And with Holly Holm versus Ronda Rousey, promotionally, the UFC can go either way, no matter who wins. And I can't think of a scenario with the UFC where they really need somebody to win. It used to be a stage, I think, after Art Davey and Horion Gracie sold to Bob Meyerowitz. There were fighters who Bob Meyerowitz really needed to win certain fights.
Sure.
But I think under the Zuffa regime, you don't have that. With all the heat of John Jones, and yet that was a markedly solid moment for the UFC. It wasn't disastrous because Jones looked as though he was exposed. It was a great moment. And I think as a promoter, and tell me if you agree, John, you have to look at all the scenarios. Where do we go with these two fighters from here?
Yeah, that's it. You know, you look at, Christ, when they were doing the frickin' the buildup for Jones and Gustafsson, they didn't even talk about Alexander Gustafsson right. and how good a fighter he was. They talked about how tall he was. This was a guy that matched up with Jones as far as height and reach. You know, you look and you go, really? That's where your buildup is? But he ended up putting on a fight that everyone to this day will say that was probably the one of the greatest light heavyweight title fights of all time, if not the number one. And you know what? Everyone would love to see that fight again. They'd love to see John Jones and Alexander Gustafsson step in the cage again to see. I want to see round number six. I got to see what's going to happen with that because you know what? Five didn't tell me everything I needed to know. That's what you're looking for as a promoter. You have that. That's freaking lightning in a bottle.
I wonder if Fedor Emelianenko's camp has veto power, or if this is Sakakibara just exerting his own influence as the head of Ryzen FF to find that right opponent. Everything I know about Fedor Emelianenko, and I've known him personally since 2008, one of my absolute favorite people in the sport, and unabashedly I say he's my all-time favorite fighter, I think he will literally fight anybody. I don't know if the people around him feel the same way.
I think, you know, absolutely. Fedor is, you know, of the opinion that he can fight with anybody, and I don't think he's trying to handpick an opponent. His, obviously, your camp is always going to try to be looking out for your best interest, you know, as much as possible. They're going to have to believe in you as a fighter, but they're not going to want to put him against certain people. But I don't think it's really, you know, Fedor or his camp, you know, denying, you know, certain requests at opponents. I think that it's, there's just not, you know, the opponent that Sakakibara thinks is going to draw, you know, the attention of the fans the way he's needing it to happen. And so he keeps on looking for that person that can possibly be that freaking lightning rod that all of a sudden gets people's attention.
John, and I've been racking my brain, and our knowledge is pretty deep of rosters. Who's out there? Again, you can think of fighters who are with Jungle Fight or with Bellator, certainly, or KSW, but they could legitimately beat Fedor Emelianenko. We gave the Bobby Lashley example. So who's out there that makes sense as an opponent now?
Why are you asking me, man? You tell me.
Because I put you on the spot on this program.
I know, man. It's like, you know, hell, I don't know who's out there. You know,
but there's tough. Guys. It really is tough.
Well, there's guys out there that I think could absolutely be great opponents for him. You know, some of them Russian. You know, you look at Minnikov, who's still the heavyweight champion in Bellator, even though there's contractual, you know, problems.
Right.
You know, look at, he can fight. That guy's good.
I think Minnikov beats Fedor Emelianenko.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. And, you know, see, so you look and say, are there guys out there that, yeah, there's guys out there, but who do you decide to put against Fedor because you don't want him to get beat? So it's a tough situation. It's not an easy situation for anyone. Who would you put against him?
It's really, you know, I thought, honestly, I had thought about James Thompson.
James Thompson beat Bobby Lashley, you would see James Thompson against Fedor. Thought that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that was almost set up because James was known in Japan.
Right.
He's liked in Japan. Yep. And it would be the natural thing because he just went and beat Bobby. And so they would try to put him in there. But I thought it would be, you know, a tough fight for him to beat, you know, Bobby. And obviously it didn't go. He got hurt. But, you know, he's fighting there, but he's not fighting against, you know, Fedor. He's fighting against who we thought was going to fight Fedor and TK.
Right. And, well, and James Thompson, he's a brawler. There's the history. You could tell the backstory that he lost to Alexander Emelianenko in Pride. And he's a brawler. He's fairly open to that overhand right hand of Fedor Emelianenko, and he doesn't have a ground control game. The concern with somebody like Lashley or somebody like Minnikov is that they just dominate Fedor Emelianenko on the ground. They just wear him down.
Well, yeah, and you're looking at someone who is going to outweigh, you know, Fedor by a certain amount. He's going to be, you know, stronger. He's a better wrestler. He's not maybe a better martial artist, but he's a better wrestler, and so he's going to be able to try to control position. Bobby's very smart as far as submissions. You know, he's technically good in the way he puts himself in position on fighters. And, you know, Fedor marks up, let's be honest. You know, Bobby starts to hit on him a little bit. It's not going to make it to where Fedor looks good as far as, even if he's not taking a ton of damage, he's going to look like he's taking damage because that's just the way he is as far as his skin. So he marks up. Not a fight that you look at if you are Sakakibara saying, yep, that's the one I want to put him against.
John, there's a final point on this, you know, and I'll give this caveat, and I've mentioned this caveat before on the program. I'm rooting for Ryzen FF. I'm so proud of the fact that I was the last English language play-by-play commentator for Pride. It really is one of the highlights of not just my MMA broadcasting career, my entire broadcasting career. My buddy Jerry Millen is heavily involved. Nobuyuki Sakakibara, who I'm a great admirer of. I want this promotion to succeed, but yet, after all the initial onslaught of love and goodwill and warm feelings, it seems like this promotion to me is doing a lot more things wrong than they are right, at least from a North American perspective. The Japanese perspective might be completely reversed, but from a North American perspective, it's not looking great for Ryzen.
No, but it's the same with any new promotion. Look, it's not easy. It is not easy to get a promotion off the ground. It's not easy to do things in a fashion that they're trying to do them. And as far as everything is out in the limelight, it's out in the media. This is not like it's some small time promotion where we're going to start trying to build, you know, ourselves and do little fights and get bigger. They're trying to start with the big boys. And to do that, you know, there's a whole lot of obstacles to, you know, have to avoid, obstacles you have to jump over. And there's the fact that, look at, there's just not that many top flight fighters out there for you as a promotion to sign when they're all signed up by other promotions. So it takes time to build and to get that roster that you need to start being competitive and putting on competitive fights.
Well, last Saturday, John, you were in Monterrey, Mexico. You worked the Bellator on Friday, a lot of air miles, and then you hustled yourself. You got to Monterrey. UFC Fight Night, a total of 13 bouts, unusually high number, 4 in total, including the main event of Neil Magny versus Kevin Gastelum, ended with split decision results. Magny, of course, won his fight. John, you refereed it. It opens up a great conversation for us about split decisions. They're wildly unpopular with fighters. They're wildly unpopular with fans. But it doesn't mean that somebody got it wrong on a split decision.
No. What it's saying is it was a close frickin' fight. You know, and the Neil Magny Gastelum fight was a close fight. The problem with that fight is, if you look at it, it's a simple fight. It's simple in saying, look at Neil Magny won the first round easy. He won the second round easy. Kevin Gastelum won the fourth round super easy. He won the fifth round easy. So I've got both guys winning two rounds, and the round of contention is going to be one round in the third. Who won that? It was close, and it was so close you had two judges giving it to Magny and one judge giving it to Gastelum, saying that entire fight is based off of one round with one judge. That's the difference in who won that fight. And that's understandable. It was a close fight as far as, if you look at how it's going to be judged, that third round is the one, and it was a close round. There's certain elements that you're going to sit there and say, well, I can say why Neil Magny won the round, and there's certain elements I can sit there and tell him why Kelvin Gastelum won the round. And look at, the judges can only go one way, and two of them went one way and one of them went the other, and we have a split decision.
I think Kelvin Gastelum has been really gracious in defeat, but still it seems like online with the fans, especially the hardcore MMA fans, there's a lot of discontentment, and maybe just the fact that there were so many decisions, fans want to see finishes. But again, 13 fights, four, so nearly a third of the entire card ends in a split decision. And I think there's the feeling, and I'm not saying it's correct, oftentimes it's not correct, but there's the feeling, wow, these judges don't know what they're doing because they can't agree on anything.
No, look, here's the truth of the matter, especially when you get to that last fight. Everybody looks at the fight and they see Kelvin in the end winning the fight. He wins the fourth round, absolutely, and he wins the fifth round, absolutely. And they basically look at him winning those rounds and say he should win the fight. Well, that's just not the way it is, because we don't go off based off of, you know, the entirety of the fight. And this is the reason why, because then you forget everything that happened in the first round, second round, maybe third round, and give nothing but credit to those last couple rounds. And now we have a guy winning a fight that sometimes maybe shouldn't win the fight overall. But everyone there is looking and saying they think that, you know, the fight should have gone to Gastelum because he was winning the fight at the end. And you know what? He was. And I understand that. And it's a matter of, it's a close fight. How much closer? What you're talking about is one judge with one round. That's the difference in that fight. How much closer can it be? The only difference is if that judge had gone a draw on that round, we would have had a draw for the fight. How's that?
Yeah, and thank goodness that we didn't have that dreaded 10-10 round.
Well, you know, you look and you say, you know, there's elements of it that you can understand giving it to. Magny controlled a lot of the fight in the third round. Gastelum had his moments in the third round, and it's what you're going to weigh out as the judge of what you're giving credit to. The real question is, if you go and you go back and you watch the fight, is the fourth round a 10-8 round for Kevin Gastelum in the fact that he knocked Neil Magny down two times and had him in positions where he was in trouble? Was there enough to say that that was a large margin round and you should have put it as a 10-8 instead of a 10-9? And so if that had happened, then we would have had a draw anyways.
John, you refereed the fight. I know everyone wants to ask you, how did you score it? But I know this from refereeing boxing, albeit in my low-level Midwest circuit. But you as a referee, and all referees will tell you, when you're refereeing, you're not really judging the fight. It's not like in boxing where the referee used to keep a scorecard. It's difficult. They're two distinctly different jobs. You might have a feel, but you're not scoring it like you would if you were an actual judge cage side.
Exactly. And you know, I don't care what the score is. The score doesn't matter to me. You know, and I would rather have it that way, because if the score matters to me, now I'm starting to think about who's scoring over
Right. Really
who's being hurt, because all I care about is who's being hurt, who's damaged, who's got a problem. That's what I think about. And, you know, in that there was, you know, a lot of back and forth. You know, the things that I can tell you off of it, what Neil Magny did in the first and second rounds were phenomenal. He was absolutely dominating that fight as far as the positions, what was occurring. Kelvin was doing a great job of defending himself. He did a great job with that. He was always working. You look at what he did. He is the picture perfect example of when we talk to fighters and say, look, this is what I want to see out of you. He did everything. He got bad spots, bad positions, and always worked himself or tried to work himself back to a better spot. So, you know, at no point was I ever even in a position to think about, oh, is he giving up on the fight? He was always doing what we ask of him. And, you know, the fight was a great fight. It really was an absolutely incredible fight. I think that Neil Magny, in the end, was getting tired because he had 2 weeks to prepare for the fight. You know, that wasn't his normal fight. And so I think his conditioning, although it's outstanding, wasn't at the peak where he's used to bringing it when he has got time and he knows he's got that fight. And so I think the push of those five rounds, by the end, he was starting to gas a little bit. And that was the real difference in what was occurring in that fourth and fifth round, was he was getting a little bit tired.
How many people came up to you and said, John, who won that fight? You were the referee. Come on, who really won it?
Yeah, man, everyone, I got everyone. Right? It's funny because, you know, I still haven't watched it, but I want to go back and watch it, and I'm going to judge it, you know, and it's going to be, you know, my information, but I have no problem with what the judges saw. And, you know, I can tell you, you know, Marcos Rosales was one of the judges on that fight. And Marcos is a guy who, you know, when I sit there and I talk about the 10-8 round, Marcos is a judge that gives out 10-8 rounds quite often.
And I asked him, I said, hey, what about the fourth round? He goes, man, I was right there. I was going to be giving it a 10-8. He says, and then Magny ended up getting up out of it. And he explained what Magny did in the end. It said, this is why I kept it as a 10-9 over a 10-8. And it was the effort of what Magny did in getting himself up back into the fight and something, you know, as far as, you know, offense that he put out. But Marcos Rosales is a guy who is given, he gave three 10-8s in the same fight. He gave it, you know, when Pat Cummings fought Kyle Kingsbury in the UFC up north in California, you know, we had a score come out, and that score was 30-24, which means that the judge has given each round is a 10-8. And at the time, I was like, are you kidding me? And I went back and watched it, and I said, you know what? Goddamn guy was right. He did deserve 10-8s in each one of those and stuff. And so, you know, Marcos is a guy that I'm going to take, and I'm going to have confidence in his ability to judge a fight and to judge, is that a 10-9 or a 10-8 round? And so, you know, I talked to him after the fight about it, and he explained why he stayed with a 10-9 over a 10-8. And look at, this is a guy that knows how to judge. So I'm gonna have to say that I think the fight was judged correctly. It was a close fight. But when people see a guy winning the last couple rounds, they naturally tend to go that way of saying, oh, he won the fight.
As a commentator, and I've seen this more than one occasion, probably 6 to 10 times in my career. John, I know you've seen this too. Split decision. Fighter A, 30-27, 30-27. And then the dissenting judge has fighter B, 30-27.
Yeah,
that's where I think you have to question the dissenting judge's scorecard. But in these cases, when you're 29-28s and 48-47s, again, you can be differing and still be right.
Yeah. You know, and there are times when, look, judges are wrong. You know, it happens. There's times when referees are wrong. There's times when fighters are wrong. You know, it's just, there's a lot of times when commentators are wrong, and you should know all of those. But, you know, it's a matter of overall, this is, you know, when someone says controversial, this is when it pisses me off when they say a controversial decision. This is not controversial at all. Not at all. All right, it's a close fight, and someone's going to win and someone's going to lose. And if Neil Magny had lost, you would have the same thing of people saying controversial. So what is it? You know, it's not controversial. It's a close fight, and the judges have got to go one way or the other. Now, if it had come up a draw, would everyone have been happy? No, they wouldn't have been happy. You know, they would have been pissed off that it was a draw. Neil Magny should have won that, or Kelvin Gastelum should have won that. Look it, it's part of fighting. There's got to be a decision made by those judges, and those judges gave the decision that they thought was correct at the time. And I don't doubt that they were right.
I think the media almost reflexively will type the word controversial in front of split decision. But it doesn't have to be controversial. I don't know what it is in the human condition, but we want everybody in authority to agree. And again, you can differ and you can still be right. You can have it 48-47 and the judge sitting the other side of the cage has it 48-47 the other way. You're both right. It works that way.
It does. Sometimes. You know? Well, and what people need to understand is, you know, when they're sitting there watching a fight, they're watching it differently than the way the judge is. The judge is looking at this element of damage. They're looking at the element of what landed in a good area, what landed in an area that I'm not going to give it credit. They're looking at the takedown and what did the person do with the takedown? Did they actually do something with it? Was it a takedown or was it just, you know what, a change of position? Where people, commentators, are saying, okay, he's got two takedowns, when I'm going to tell you as a judge, he's got zero for takedowns. Okay, the change of position is not a takedown, but the commentator has now put it in the mind of the fan, there's two takedowns. And so they're sitting there saying, well, he's got two takedowns. No, he doesn't. Okay, changes of positioning is not takedowns. Takedowns are things where you affect the fighter in a negative way because of the elevation and the impact of it. That's a takedown. It's when you put them in a position that you end up doing more damage with that position. That's a takedown. Because the fight ends up in a position from standing to they're on their butts to their back standing, that is not what we look at as judging as a takedown. That's just a change of position. People need to understand that judges are looking at the fight usually with a little bit more of an understanding of the sport than the commentators even sometimes.
No, it's very true.
Or the fans.
And as a commentator, my baseline is always neutrality. I have some very close friends who fight, who I've commentated. I give the example. Neil Grove fought in Bellator a night before one of his fights in Kansas City. He actually had dinner at my house, but he wound up losing the fight to Thiago Santos. At that time, as a commentator, I did not care who won or lost. Afterwards, I felt bad for my friend Neil. But at the time, I did not care. And as a referee, as a judge, as a commentator, although not all commentators have the same philosophy as me in combat sports or in any sports for that matter, you have to be neutral because you can start to influence public opinion on saying things like that. Also, and John, I'm asking you about how many people came up to you in Monterrey who won that fight. Countless times throughout my career. It just happened to me when I was in Beijing working my debut for ONE Championship. Who do you think won that fight? And I always have to give the honest answer. You know what? I was commentating it. I wasn't judging it. I would have to go back and watch because I really don't know.
Yeah, see, and what I use is I use the basic – oh, it's simple. Neil Magny did. The judges gave him the decision.
Yeah.
Okay? I don't sit there and I'm not going to doubt it until I've looked at it and I can sit there and say that, hey, now you know what? I've watched it and I think that, you know, fighter A beat fighter B. But – you know, whenever someone says, you know, who do you think won that fight? It's pretty simple. You know, fighter A did. The judges gave him the decision. That's just the way it is.
I know when you're judges training for MMA, and our buddy Rob Hines does this also in his judges training, you guys will often turn down the sound. So you're not only turning down the crowd, you're turning down the commentators. Oftentimes you'll see in your room that that affects how they score the fight. The crowd can influence subconsciously. The commentators can definitely influence subconsciously. With the volume down, sometimes the scorecards get changed.
Absolutely. They get changed a lot. You know, it's always good to have, if you're watching a fight, having sound is a good thing as far as the sound of the fight. But to have the sound of commentators, the sound of corners, all this thing, that stuff you have to tune out. And if you can't tune it out, then you're going to have a problem. You know, I can tell you right now, Joe Rogan influences more people into believing fighter A beat fighter B than anybody I know because he has that where they believe what he's saying. And sometimes, you know, Joe is right, you know, in what he's saying. And sometimes he's absolutely going in a direction that you go, no. That's not right. He likes that fighter and he's giving props to the fighter that in the end you go, man, you know what? What are you talking about? You know, I have a great example of one that I made a bet on the fight with a friend as far as, you know, just dinner. And it wasn't, you know, it was a matter of jiu-jitsu. And we were talking about the style of jiu-jitsu of two fighters. And one was a fighter that was from, you know, Joe's background with Eddie Bravo. And the other was a basic jiu-jitsu guy, basically from, you know, the old school jiu-jitsu. And I said, look it, you know, that guy's got really cool moves, but when you pass his guard, he is in trouble and he's not going to be able to do that stuff. And this guy's jiu-jitsu is so good. He's going to be in trouble. And he says, no, I don't think he's going to get him in this. Okay. Well, you know, and we're watching and Joe is just tearing up, you know, the guy that I have, the thing, oh, you know, he's pretty basic here. And he's all just blasting how great this other guy is, all the point where he gets submitted. And I just started laughing my ass off saying, yep, tell him how good he is now. And it's not that he's a bad fighter. It's just that, you know, Joe starts to jump on the side that he likes and people start to, they just start listening to it. And eventually it becomes fact and truth. And you have to have the opinion that you need to understand what you're looking at and not so much take the side of what the commentator is saying, take the information that they're talking about, but sometimes understand when what they're saying just isn't matching up to what you're seeing.
Well, and I know a lot of judges around the world listen to this program, which we're very appreciative of. And whether it's an Emmy show and it's the hometown hero or it's a big professional show and it's the main event fighter in his home country, the fans of the favored fighter often will react differently. So a jab may be shot out and they may really react and the fighter who's against their guy lands a big hook and they're quiet. Or you have the corners, every thigh kick that lands, they give the ole and they cheer. And all of that has to be tuned out by judges.
Absolutely. You know, I'm telling you, I have, you know, been at events. You know, Greg Jackson is one of the greatest as far as influencing judges. He cracks me up, you know, but he'll sit there and he's very calm about how he says it, but he'll, when his fighter doesn't, that a baby, beautiful, that's what we're looking for. Yes, yes. And he starts going, right? And I'm just sitting there laughing and then I'll go and I'll pick up and I'll watch his fighter lose the round.
There's not a doubt in my mind. If I was judging, the other guy gets the round. I'll go and pick up the card. And normally I don't look, but sometimes I'll pick up the card and I'll look at that judge that was sitting there. And there it is. He scored it for Jackson's fighter. And I go, oh, my God, he did it again. Greg Jackson is a magician. I love the fact how he can influence people.
John, we've talked about this numerous times on this program, but it bears repeating, especially because we pick up a few hundred new listeners every week. There's a reason why the way combat sports evolve, starting with boxing, why the judges aren't positioned together, either seated or standing, why they're positioned at three different vantage points.
Yeah, there's a reason. And part of it is, you know, they don't want them conversing in any fashion. They don't want them getting the views of somebody else. They want them being a sole entity. And they want them seeing the fight from those different positions, because sometimes it is a different fight from those positions. And they're going to try to say, then the whole reason for the three judges is they want two of them to coincide. And if one doesn't get to see the fight the same as the other ones, that's okay with the way, the mentality of the way we're going to score the fight. It's, you know, to sit there and say that they have to be unanimous, they don't. It just has to be two of them. It's a majority, and that majority is there for a reason. And, you know, trust me, you know, people that have not judged, that have gone then and been put in the position to judge and told, no, this is how you're going to do it, when put in that position, they see the fight completely differently. It's not the same judging as it is watching as a fan.
So the final point on this, my 10-year-old daughter, Ellie, well, my 4-year-old Hadley and my 10-year-old Ellie both think the world of you, John, and Big John the Carthy, as my 4-year-old Hadley calls you. But my 10-year-old Ellie, she goes to a lot of fights with me, and because I'm on the Kansas Athletic Commission, she now gets to be the scorecard collector, which is the thrill of her life. I post a lot of those videos on Facebook. And you told her, John, and I've repeated that to her, Rob Hines has said this as well, you have to be fast. Don't let the judges hold the scorecards, right, because they can change their mind. So Ellie literally gets in a sprinter stance. But it's true. She has fun with it, and she takes it extremely seriously. She's a bit like her dad. She has a tendency to do everything at full volume. But there really is truth in that. You do not want to give judges time after the bell rings to contemplate. You want that snap decision.
Well, I hear judges all the time saying, you know, yeah, I should be given the full minute to make up my mind. Look it, you know, as simple as I can say it. If you don't know who won that round when that bell goes off, you got a problem. If you don't know where you're at when the bell goes off, you've got a problem. I can tell you that, you know, the way I judge is it's mathematical in fashions that I have numbers in my head as far as, and I know if I have fighter A winning by a certain amount, I know if I have fighter B winning by a certain amount, or I know if it's even. And so when that bell goes off, all I have to do is take that and put it down onto paper. And so to sit there and say that, oh, I need time to think about it, that means that you're not judging the fight effectively.
See, John, you're positively influencing the next generation of people working in MMA, all the way down to 10-year-old girls.
Well, you know what? 10-year-old girls are going to be taking over the sport. So,
yeah, you don't know how true that is, my 10-year-old and my 4-year-old. Well, we are back with you next week for an all-new episode of Let's Get It On, first available on Friday. Download and subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes Store. For Android, download the Stitcher app and subscribe. And you can go straight to our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. You can also find us on social media, facebook.com/letsgetitonpodcast, and on Twitter, @PodcastMMA for this show, and for us personally, @JohnMcCarthyMMA and @SeanWheelock. To ask us a question, make a comment, or inquire about becoming a sponsor of Let's Get It On, email us at info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. That's info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. For Big John McCarthy, producer Chris Lakin, and our entire crew, I'm Sean Wheelock. Thanks for listening, everyone. This has been a presentation of Lineup Media Group, online at lineupmediagroup.com.
Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock on the Lineup Media Group Podcast Network. Leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, or wherever you listen to the show. If you have questions, comments, or are interested in sponsoring Let's Get It On, contact us at info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Get all the Lineup Media Group podcasts, like Jason Bucks and Panger on NHLPodcast.com, Ocho Man, Behind the 8-Ball, and You're On the Clock NFL on our website at lineupmediagroup.com.